हेलो नमस्ते आदाब जिंदाबाद वेलकम टू अनदर एपिसोड ऑफ फुर्सत फेमिनिज्म दिस इज अरुंधति
दिस इज दीपा
एंड वी हैव अनामिका जॉइनिंग अस हु रीच्ड आउट टू अस थ्रू इंस्टाग्राम हु बोथ दीपा एंड आई डोंट नो एट ऑल बिफोर दिस पॉडकास्ट एंड होपफुली विल बी थिक फ्रेंड्स आफ्टर सो अनामिका रीच्ड आउट टू अस सेइंग वी शुड बी टॉकिंग अबाउट फेमिनिस्ट बॉसेस And my sort of knee-jerk reaction to that was, what an oxymoron. But, so maybe you can walk us through what made you want to talk about that, Anamika, because both of us are deeply intrigued and also have a bunch to say about at least bosses in feminist spaces. So, yes, go ahead. What brought you to the topic and what do you want to talk about?
I think in a very technical sense, it's dissemination of information. Because I think everybody who, let's say, identifies as a feminist would have had these conversations in their own silos. Might as well, more people should understand what it means. The good and the bad. Also, COVID was going on. I was not in a very good mind space. So a lot of like bad traumatic memories was coming. I was like, okay, this can be like a feminist podcast.
Because what is feminism if not mining our trauma for content?
Exactly. More gender responsive stand-up comedy, but we are more serious and make lesser money.
Where would you start talking about feminist bosses in general? Like, how would you frame the whole thing? From your experience, maybe.
Yeah, I think my first experience, she was not a boss. She was more of a mentor and she has remained that for the last 10 years, because I met her in 2011. And she really defined and set the bar really, really high of feminist mentors. So she's the mentor who I still go back. Initially, I used to ask her questions like, but this person identifies like this. So is this person that? And I was 20 and obviously cisgendered, very, very heterosexual and heteronormative at that point in time. And I never was like, what is this question? Or why the fuck are you asking me this? It was never like that. And I think it became such an enabling space to not just ask these very weird, stupid questions, but also to go back and really learn that now that I'm saying that these were stupid questions, obviously there is a trajectory of learning which happened because there was this enabling space, right? You create an engaging space for somebody who's really new by engaging with them in a positive manner rather than saying you're stupid or you're privileged. Of course, those two things are there. That is why you have gone to them and wanted to learn. It was great to understand those nuances, not just at that point of time when I was working with her for about, I think, 4 or 5 months. But I took that learning into a lot of other spaces for not just critique, but also myself. The fact that she had that very actionable things was something.
Just leading by example of some
sort. Yeah, that is very interesting. And I have not seen that in any other space. So that is one. And the second bit is the motivation bit of it, where a lot of times you hate the workspace so much that you just don't want to get up and go, no matter how great the organization is working for. And for all the organizations I have worked for, they are doing really like amazing work. Or individuals or professors, feminist professors I've worked with, I have actually grown up either reading them or looking at them or wanting to work with them. And then you go and you're like, the motivation bit just goes, because you then become this hyperbolic idol who nobody can question because you're older, more experienced, and apparently knows everything, which is literally not feminism. I'm not even saying there are different feminisms, so that might be one. No, it's not feminism. I'm sorry. I know you guys must have also done it, and I have done it, where we have literally left our whole lives to move to like a remote part of the country to work because we really believe, one, in that person, but also what that person represents within that organization. And then you go and you're like, oh, fuck, this is just not worth the effort. And when I say not worth the effort, I'm not saying the organization at all, because the organization is also made up of so many other people who have built lives and narratives from that work they have been doing for so long. But that is completely, I think, a deviant from the people who run it, and which is the contradiction in itself. Because in a lot of these places where it's very like ground up work and there are so many people involved in it, I have actually learned way more from the people on the field. But there is barely anything I've learned from them. Rather, what I've learned is to not be that leader or not be that mentor. I have moved out of that feminist space. It has been 5 years. I knew why I wanted to move out, because I didn't want somebody to message me at 4 a.m. saying, oh, you didn't do that report. And somebody's worked on labor, man. I mean, come on. You've worked on labor and women. Come on.
And you're right. You know, all of this comes back to this idea of like, disseminating, because we are all occupying whisper circles in our own organizations and our own little circles. Everybody should know that this is universal reality, that it can be questioned. And wherever they are in that space, if they feel that that is not the norm to question that kind of leadership, it is okay to question it and to be like, no, this is not okay.
I don't think the questioning also exists. The questioning is just in your head, because there's no space for questioning. No. I understand if your work needs somebody who has experiences in the rural areas, take that person, na, quote unquote intersectional. As feminists, when you're working in these organizations which are doing such great work, you are just working all the time. And you're engaged. You can't even bloody cut off from work.
No, there is no time off. Yeah.
Like after I got out of the feminist space and I started looking, like, oh fuck, there is literally a 9-to-5. I didn't know.
I'm not being useful to the world if I'm not like burning my candle on both ends.
And you're not changing the world. The worst part is, in one breath, it is about how women should have wealth and control over land, XYZ. And in the other breath, it's like, oh, you are working for a cause. How can you ask about money? I was like, do you realize these two things are stupid? You idiot. Imagine, like, from that to actually respecting an HR who has an incremental policy for you, who is not a feminist, but at least gives you money to pay rent in Bombay here. Or wherever.
One of my closest friend's favorite quote is that I will work in an organization that pays me enough to be able to, you know, afford therapy.
Yeah!
Rather than work in an organization which talks about therapy but doesn't pay me to even go for therapy.
If you are getting people on board who are, let's say, from a particular institute or from a particular privilege, which is urban, upper class, whatever, don't take them. If these privileged pricks like me, who are working on the ground and learning from your field staff, that means that your quote-unquote field staff is way more adept to doing these things, right? Why aren't their capacities being done like that?
Or they being paid higher than yeah. what they're being paid. I think in all women's organization, the first, I think, 1 month, I just couldn't get over what it felt like to just be in all women's spaces. I have to say that was in and of itself incredibly liberating. Just what it feels like to be in a room with the top management of the organization and they're all women, just all of them sitting around a table with the buck stopping at them and taking these decisions. It was something that really just completely moved me. And over time, I've had this conversation with my queer friends and they've said, see, if you feel this way about women being in a room, imagine how it would feel for a trans person to be leading an organization of gay and lesbian people holding these spaces. What would that feel like? In all of this idealism that I got into, I was just like, oh my God, this is great, right? I wasn't a taught feminist, so I hadn't sort of studied gender or feminism in my academia. So I came into the work very, very willing to be taught, already sort of on the back foot saying, please put me wherever you need me, give me whatever money you want, very happy to do whatever it is. And I know that there is a lot I have to learn. I don't know anything. Okay, this is what I started with. And they rugged me, which is good. Put me in the deepest corners of the field, said, do all of this stuff. Fantastic. Earlier on, there was a lot of peer learning that kept happening. But I think over time, what I started realizing as my own feminism kept getting sharpened in extremely different intersectional contexts, it very quickly started becoming apparent that kind of leadership that can exist, the kind of person that you're reporting to, the relationship that they can have with you, it became more and more and more jarring. And that slow disillusionment also started creeping in. All the things you said, right? Like there's all of these things you espouse, you say all of these things on the outside, but there is this very holier-than-thou-ness about the work. At the end of the day, I really feel, you know, in the development sector especially, if people can just treat jobs and as things that give you salary and not as things that are changing the world, but as just things that you're doing to make ends meet and because you're plugging into a need gap that exists in the world, then much of this trauma of the people that work in these organizations would go away. Because I think there is an expectation of always being underpaid and overworked and never being able to complain about it. And at the same time, the one thing that is expected of you all the time is to show up with 100% emotional capacity for every work, Right, because that is the main call of the job, is just incredible and unrelenting emotional labor. You're available all the time. You know, your phone is available all the time. You can be emailed at any time. There is no personal. When we think about leading by example in everyday things, I think the organization where I was working, I think, was also kind of operating at the intersections of Gandhianism and feminism. So there was this very, very conscious sort of rituals of washing your own dishes, cleaning up after yourself. Everybody does their own thing. Everybody sits on the ground. In all of those fronts, fairly clear. But at the same time, I think there is a tendency in all of these organizations to talk about how there is this very gendered kind of labor across the board in every other space. But unfortunately, still the office spaces are incredibly gendered.
Or caste-based gender, but minus all other intersectionality.
And what also ends up happening is that, especially when the leadership is fully Savarna, there is massive class-caste solidarity that operates in the organization. And it is very insidious. So you notice patterns of newer people come in who have the markers of social class, but don't have any of the know-how or the experience or whatever. But immediately their voice is being amplified, they're being given spaces to talk, they're suddenly being given a lot of opportunities. But everybody else who's been sort of around for a really long time keeps getting the backseat. There is a sort of Savarna savior complex that comes into the whole thing, where it's like, oh my god, I've done so much for you guys. How can you do the gaddari of speaking up against me? And so there is a very strong culture of inhibiting feedback loops.
I think there are 2-3 layers to it. So there is somebody else who is worse off than you and they're getting paid less money, so you don't deserve it. The point is not who is deserving or not.
It's a false equivalent.
Why the fuck? Structures of salary. Put na. Sabke liye sahi ho jayega. And the structures of salary and layers and all of this are very problematic. I am myself self-critical of it. As a person who has managed people, I know that somebody is getting more money than the other person and they really don't deserve it. But that is how structures work. But on the other hand, from a feminist practice, you can make it more equitable, right? So you don't have to tell me that I don't deserve an increment as opposed to another person who also deserves an increment. Like, come on. And it's not about this whole concept of caste is merit, but it is about the fact that you need to have a structure where everybody gets paid properly, not just you. So that is one bit. The second bit is they said, oh, but you know, I make only this much. So how can you make more than me? Agree. However, as somebody who's now like known people and how things work, you get this much from this job. There are 15 other people in your silo who's asking you to come for like trainings and all of that, you are getting nothing paid more than your salary. So please pop off. So technically, you should then not be taking any money from the organization. No, if you're working so much.
There are other pots of money, yeah.
The other, this whole Savarna concept and how feminist bosses don't consider power as something. You know, I have created a space which is equitable. So you question, no, it doesn't work like that. I'm sorry. I still remember, and this is so jarring, my upper caste boss actually has grown up in a very posh locality in a very big urban city. There was one of the tea facilitators who had come and mera vrat hai, she said, that I'm on a fast and all that. And this person who has all the power in the world is like, why are we keeping a fast? We don't believe in all of this in our organization. But she has to go back home, na? She has her mother-in-law, she has X, she has Y, she has Z. First of all, you're not paying her money. On top of that, you want her to fight with all of this bullshit. And I'm not saying that this questioning is not important.
But who gets to question is also a thing.
Yeah, and this is a development sector problem in general, where development sector generally feels some sort of ownership over everybody's narrative and everybody's trauma and everybody's life problems. Feels like they have an entitlement to demand that to be repeated over and over again, and that labor to be performed over and over again, that trauma labor. But at the same time, you do wish that the feminist spaces within the development sector would be different. Find a way to be more transparent both ways.
So ironic, I don't know, it's hypocritical, I would say, that when you are creating a space where someone is supposed to talk about their trauma, that's the only space where they're allowed to talk about their trauma. So if you talk about your personal relationship in your own friend circle within the organization, then for some reason that is not work ethics, that's not professional, that's not talking about things when you are assigned to talk about it. And I used to find it ridiculous because it's like, here, what is the whole point of saying that you're creating safe spaces? One of the biggest things that I've learned in this all these years is that we just presume that if you create a feminist organization, you know how feminist power really works. But what you essentially have done is you've created a feminist organization and then have that same patriarchal structure, patriarchal capitalistic power structure, and you're just reproducing the same narrative again and again and again. And you are not even ready to be questioned on that, which brings in a very different kind of guilt, is what I've realized.
I actually have a question, thoda sa, just to turn things around. Why does this happen, right? Let's give everybody benefit of doubt and say everybody has good intentions, right? They mean to lead as feminists and in a completely feminist way. All of these organizations and all of these feminist bosses, I really, really, really get a sense that there is a structural overhaul that needs to happen for feminist leadership to occur in any space, okay? In the sense that we cannot continue to operate in corporate structures and expect them to suddenly be able to purge patriarchy and capitalism from them. And so if feminist power is a reimagining an alternative seeking method, then it has to be completely reimagined. So many times we tend to think of feminists in leadership as people that are individuals and are erring at an individual level. And my contention is that having been the person that, for example, Deepa reported to, I think I was constantly feeling like I was burning both ends if I wanted to be the most feminist version of the boss that I wanted to be. Okay? In the sense that if I wanted to be kind and empathetic and give people space and listen and create really equitable norms, lead by example, do all of these things, but also continue to be embedded in a system that was constantly accountable financially to a state that is truly draconian towards organizations like this, if I was embedded in a system that is also extremely vertical in the fact that the buck stops at you, you will be asked questions in a very real way. What ended up basically happening was I would act like the buffer. If I said, okay, you know, the team is not able to do this, I can see that I will not give them this work, or I will give it to them. And if they say they can't do it, I'll take it on myself. But I'll not pass it on because, you know, the structure is holding me accountable to this. So from both ends, I was basically completely packed and also emotionally completely exhausted, right? Because I was a sounding board across the board. And where am I sounding to? Who is my sounding board? There is no such system. And so in all of that, what I realized is that as an individual, you can try to be the most feminist version of the leadership position you are taking. Unless the structure is completely overhauled, there cannot be. So what we tried to do as a microcosm in that little program that we were running was some form of collective leadership, of collective accountability taking, of collective decision making that really prevented you from feeling that the buck stops at you. There were four other people willing to say, no, the buck stops at us. That really worked. But my question to both of you, is it structurally at all possible to have feminist bosses? I understand that that term is an oxymoron, but is it possible to perform feminist leadership in the kind of spaces that we have seen and that we have been a part of? Is a question that I've been sitting with for a really long time.
Like now, in terms of progressive, like this is very like corporate talk, a lot of people might not like it, but a lot of progressive human resource managers are also talking about lateral leadership. Like I remember one of the bosses I worked for, he's showing me the organogram of the program I was part of, and you know, like people who report to him and then other people like so I said. On day one, I remember saying that this is just a lateral leadership. Everybody on this chart is an expert of their own field, so you do not assume that if somebody is reporting to me or X or Y, they don't know stuff. And you as a manager then set the tone for your group that this is how it works. Just because you are in the X or Y or wherever, that doesn't mean that the other people are like, oh, you don't know this. No, everybody knows. That is where you fight aspects of ageism and all of that stuff. Because there might be other people who have done so much more than you, but differently for a lesser period of time. But that doesn't mean that you can diss them, right? So in the same way, why are we not doing that in like feminist organization. Nobody has told me that everybody is the expert. There is only this one boss who is great in training, great in gender.
I have heard this a lot, that everybody is an expert. Not an expert, but like everybody knows their shit. Consequently, what people try to build in lieu of lateral leadership is collective leadership, in which you try to create bodies that are taking decisions collectively, where what the organization looks like, what the organization decides, etc., sort of comes back to the collective. But my problem with the collective is there has to be an equitable approach taken to the collective. You're just saying by giving you membership to the collective, you're suddenly, we are all equal. Ye nahi hota hai. We are not operating in an ideal world. Then it is so highly tokenistic because...
And extractive.
Yeah, and you're assuming that the people that have for all your life worked under you, quote unquote, have reported to you, have relied on you to take all the decisions, will suddenly, just by virtue of this structure, feel empowered to take decisions on their own. It's not going to happen. They have been socialized into thinking you are the last person that all the validation needs to come from. I was in such a structure and I was the maybe rabble-rouser, troublemaker, whatever, of that group. I would try to disagree with certain things, whatever, but there is no political clout you have in being a part of that collective, because that is already focused in one individual or two individuals within that collective. Then it's just completely tokenistic. You're literally creating time and resource waste in that whole process.
So two ways which I have seen in one of the organizations I worked with, not with a very great experience myself, but the way the collective was empowered was through a lot of trainings. And I think that works great when you're talking about collective leadership. So that definitely a lot of organizations don't do, because now what happens is that a lot of progressive funders talk about participation, collectives, etc., etc.
And organizational development.
Which I think is very important. So if you don't build that and say, maine collective meeting kya, kuch nahi kiya tum, please. So that is one bit. And the second bit is that even after a lot of like sessions, until it's like really run over a lot of years and it is then internalized, until people in collective communities start to de-socialize themselves from that, is where a collective decision will come from. And from other collectives, there is a directive way of doing this.
Of course, there is nothing wrong with there being directive. There is still something to be said for some agency that people in the collective may have to actually disagree.
By directive, I meant that you as a leader, collective leader, quote unquote, have gone into the meeting thinking this is what they will decide and that is what they have decided. So that kind of directive. Matlab, obviously, as a leader, you have to set up a broader structure so that people can think also. No? Otherwise, they are just feminist talking. But that's the thing, right? Like, one, you don't give them structure, so then there is chaos. And when you give them structure, it is so top-down that they're like, okay, okay, yeah, okay, 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 I don't know anything. Because if you know what you want, then why are you asking? So also, if you're trying to de-socialize yourself from stuff you're grown up, especially when it is a very ideology-centric work, right? So you need to give people spaces to self-reflect, to think, to train them. All of that is dependent.
And even to make mistakes, there is this whole essentialization of the fact that, oh, we have been making all the right choices. Now, you are also supposed to make all the right choices above that. Like, hum 20 saal se tumhe lead kar rahe hain, to hum jo kar rahe hain, wahi tumhe bhi karna hai. If you never ever vacate that space at all, your presence in that space can completely change people's behavior there. So, when we were working in the team, one of the things that worked, the five of us who were the team had our own spaces as well. Like, we knew where we are operating. So, it was never that Arundhati is our boss or whatever manager. So, she has to be everywhere. So every single decision that I'll take will be coming from there. There will be this facade because I am in love with her. So there's a facade of me believing that everything that she's saying is right, you know, which is something that I saw in the other structure that I was seeing parallelly running, where yes, you might be in awe of your manager or whoever is your leader, but that leader has to just vacate that space and leave. And you can make mistakes and then, you know, move ahead with that mistake. I mean, you know, I went to one of these stakeholder meetings at some point where there were these feminists, older feminists, trying to trash younger feminists and say that, matlab, kuch nahi aata in logon ko.
False spaces.
Yeah. And there was this constant conversation around the fact that, oh, they've not read history, oh, they don't know this, oh, they don't know that. And I was just like, when you guys started off, did you know all the history in the world? Like, was it all the right decisions all at the right time, never made a mistake. This was my biggest sense of betrayal. You know, main tumhe se hero worship kar rahi hu. You don't even trust me. That's a very, very weird relationship to have. That
very power unequal relation. Like huge power inequality.
You are the powerful person and you are somehow constantly questioning my intention more than anything else. You are like, oh, you are not in the right space and we have decided that. So when that is the scenario, when there's that kind of distrust, then there's no way to ever create the system that we are talking about. We don't even believe in the capabilities of those people. We don't believe that if we move out, they'll probably be able to do something by themselves. We just want, yeah, we want everything by our whatever template that we have created, because that's the only way you can change anything, maybe.
I think that is also the issues with collectives, right? You are cutting the access of younger people trying to get your collectives. Because if we as feminists and we as women are critiquing these very male-centric spaces, then you're also creating those kind of exclusionary spaces within your collective, right? So then how are you operating? The fact that you are saying you're a feminist, the whole space, and when I say the whole space, I mean everybody in that space should have this sense of mentorship, space to express, space to be incorrect, right?
Point actually about mentoring as a whole. This is an experience that I've had very closely. This is a part of a larger program of feminist mentoring. I had three rotating mentors for 3 years. It really, really, really worked. But my analysis is it really worked because it was outside the system. If the mentorship came from within the organization, if the mentorship came from somebody that I was directly reporting to or my manager or something like that, there would be massive conflict of interest. It is, I think, very difficult to create this kind of spaces of feminist mentoring that I was able to tap in those 3 years, because fundamentally all three of them came from the space of, I see you, I hear you, like I think you are legit and let's start from there. And even if any questioning of what I was thinking was coming, it was always posed as a question rather than a critique. Always a way to like get me to think about it, get me to reflect on it, get me to act on it. And that is such a fundamentally feminist practice, and it's tough. It takes a lot to not directly give the answers, not directly give the critiques, not directly give the solutions, but to say, okay, I will sit here and I will help you think through, because your answers in your context are things that I cannot provide. That is a reality that I think if people would just have, there is more humility across the board. So even if they were mentoring us, there was that humility that I think we don't know if we fully understand your context, but these are some questions that are coming to my mind when I'm listening to you as a third person. And I think that kind of humility is very difficult to do when you're embedded within the same system. The system has tasked you with having the solutions, but you're trying to provide feminist mentoring where you're trying to say, okay, let me just have this conversation with you, Deepa, and try to figure out what is happening in the field. And then on the other hand, the system will say, are, why you didn't give her a solution? Now she's sitting there 3 months trying new things. At the end of the day, yes, some completely new dhacha will appear and some completely new thing you will try and it'll really work. But the system lacks patience when it is not fundamentally feminist. That is my problem.
There's an essential understanding of that it is not efficient to give somebody that time to learn. Efficiency ka maina, matlab hame aise deliverable chahiye na. Then you never have that space and you never have that confidence to be able to take decisions. One of the most ridiculous things that I heard recently, one of these very big names of feminist movement basically said that I have a young feminist who's my boss, and that's how we are promoting young women leadership. And we were 5 women sitting in that room, we looked at each other, we're like, oh, okay.
So where is that boss you have? Where is she?
You made her your own boss. That's it. Like Arundhati makes me her boss, and that's how her that power relationship is.
In some sense, you know, this idea of like vacating power. So I think instead of collective leadership, what might actually work, I don't know, I'm proposing this, is the idea of rotational leadership of some sort, where that position is not always associated with one individual. It's like, oh, forever and always, till the end of time, this position will be held by this person, this power will be concentrated in this individual. Because I was having a conversation with my cousin the other day, and she was talking about how her prof parents in IITs, they have some sort of like rotational head of department system where it's never one person and it keeps changing. And she was talking about how with that change, what essentially happens is that every time a new person comes in, and especially if this is a diverse group, and especially if there is a range of people represented, and especially, of course, if they are listened to and supported by the larger collective, a fresh set of eyes comes in all the time. And then the fundamental feminist principle of the personal being the political becomes so much easier because there is constantly a set of eyes looking within, not just without. And that idea of the organization itself being reflexive starts to happen. Because say if you keep shifting leadership constantly, and it can be a rotational system, but that rotational system happening not just with sort of this upper creme de la creme, but happening sort of across the board and on all different levels, not just sort of just the ED keeps changing, but different kinds of things keep changing, different leaderships keep coming. There is a tendency to look within and say, okay, what part of this system, when I was accessing it as person with lesser power, what were my problems with this system and how can I fix it now that I do have power? And that's one possible way of thinking about it. It's tough. Feminist organizations and feminist leaders as a whole really shy away from thinking about their own organizations and their own leadership and where can that get better? Because so many times feminists get into an educational mode ki matlab hum duniya ko sikhayenge feminism kya hai, ki matlab where is the space to look within and think about. There are smaller organizations I've been a part of that are very good at this practice, but I think the larger the organization gets, the tougher.
This rotational leadership, what, like, in my experience I've seen happening is that should not be representational, right? So it's not just like you give this position to this person and that's it. There is a transfer of resources that you are holding on to. So like even in the example that I just gave, you just made somebody your boss doesn't mean that that person becomes your boss. You need to be able to just, you know, shift that resource to them. Yeah? And that is not happening because they're actually not able to dissociate themselves. That person and that organization is synonymous for many, many, many people. Then I don't know how that rotational leadership will ever work.
No, if certain people have occupied power for a really long time, they need to leave. Then some form of rotational leadership is possible or collective leadership is possible. With them staying in the structure, it's not possible. It's just simply.
So why don't we do like big feminist programs or whatever, where it is totally decentralized from anywhere you're working? So you can have a list of feminist mentors or whatever who have had experiences in a particular field or a particular perspective of feminism, and one feminist or one person who wants to know about feminism can access five people who have had five differences, right? And then you can work in any organization, feminist or not, and you can do your own thing. But why are feminists who are these, oh, tum achhe feminist nahi ho, tum bure feminist ho, you've gotten married or you've not gotten married or you've had children or not had children. All of those discussions can come to an end. Dude, I have no idea. I had so many, like, I thought I'd bitch more, but like,
we are always accused of only talking about the problem.
That was part one of our episode. We'll be back shortly. Stay tuned.
Feminists are talking about structure. It's like, yes, what is the structure of mentorship? What is my expectation as a new person getting into an organization, which I've literally been like fangirling forever, right? So what is the organization also giving?
I think what I realize constantly when I talk about feminist leadership is that I have a constant tendency to make it about the individual. And you're right, this conversation we had at the end about structures is, it's so important to critique structures that the leadership is embedded within. A critique and change and overhaul and rethink. And in a state where that is weaponizing the FCRA to shut down any voices of dissent, that's one thought that I keep having, is that you do understand that there will be hierarchy. Within that hierarchy, how do you operate to sort of cut through all of the many, many ways in which power becomes more and more and more unequal? To put money in the hands of the people, like constantly redistribute wealth in ways that you're asking for the rest of the society to keep doing, put wealth in the hands of the DBA community, women, and just do it.
This is a very good example. I remember one of my batchmates took up a mining job, worked with a mining company. She came from a Dalit background and she was heavily criticized to the core. However, she didn't have support of her parents when she had come to the institute to sort of study, right? So, and all of these people were supported by their parents, the critiques, they were supported by their parents, they were doing a lot of other things. I think she worked in that organization for 3-4 years, I'm not very clear on that. But right now she has literally taken that money and she's running a Dalit women's organization in a particular part. So the point is that, and the others who critiqued it are still doing something because some paisa is coming from somewhere else. So the point is that this whole, and this narrative we hear from the corporates who say that I am here for 5 years, I'll do this work because I want to travel. Or I am here for 5 years because I want to get out of my house. Why? And these are corporates where, the political space to express individuality, independence is not there. So why is it that we are not recognizing it? Right? Because we are talking about it. We are talking about marriages. That this exchange of labor, unpaid care work, XYZ, but we are not doing it for the people who are working for us, or working with us, or communities who we are working for, technically speaking, right? Then what is it that we're getting back to the community? Apart from all of this whole beneficiary-led empowerment rights, XYZ, but what is the monetary benefit of it to the community, right?
When we think about feminist leadership, there is a very strong aspect of converging at the intersectionalities of all of these realities and say, okay, how do we move towards an anti-caste space and a queer friendly space and a gender equitable space? And it has to operate at all of those cross sections. It cannot just pick one and be like, chalo, at least men are also making tea and women are also making tea, but both of them are Dalit. Matlab, kya,
No, I think the idea is to that whole feminism in general, all of us, right? We have also dealt with idealism. Bus, everything will end today. It won't. Come on. So, you have said, these 3-4 things or these millions of intersectionalities cannot come from one leadership. So, that's the whole concept of this. But also, even if there is one leadership, the leadership should be open now because, let's say, for example, I'm a Dalit woman coming in. So, my perspectives will be different. So let's say the organization learns those perspective at that point of time. Let's say you are coming in from a queer perspective. Your and queer perspective also the intersectionalities between the whole LGBTQIA+, right? That perspective. So your learning should not technically stop, and that is where we sort of get flustered, right? Where this one boss with that one perspective is only working around them, and then there is no space to learn because if you are getting in new people, you are getting in quote-unquote new talent, as you say it now, that talent also comes with experiences, right? So get those experiences to make the organization better and not saying, oh, this is what you have done for 25 years. Now that's about it. No.
Yeah, and to carry up from Anamika's point and one of the points that she made initially about, trainings and how you should have organizations build perspectives of everybody, that to build that organization perspective. I was suddenly thinking that when does that perspective building stop? As in, you enter an organization, that perspective building begins, you go to the field, you learn from the field, you get out from the field, and then you're suddenly in a position where you're teaching the field. Matlab, especially in understanding of the Gandhian way of working, is that glorification of simplicity and the glorification of, oh, we wash our own dishes and, oh, we clean our own spaces. Arey yaar, toh theek hai na, matlab, why is that a medal or a badge to wear all the time? How is that a certificate for you? I don't understand. Secondly, exactly the thing that I said earlier, that how do you define that, okay, now you have learned, now you become the leader, And now you don't need to learn from the same community. Now you're done. Now the community learns from you. Which is, and essentially that's what organizations largely are also doing, right? When they are so-called creating collectives, making these groups, forcing people to have some form of kinship. In so many of these collectives, so many of these ground-level collectives, the collective itself is a source of employment for the people who are part of the collective. And then you're just forcing that collective to be together. And then there comes the monetary aspect of it, where you're like, "Arey, tum collective mein ho, toh tum matlab paise ke liye thodi collective mein ho, na? Matlab, I have the privilege of being a part of a collective where I don't need money from that collective. I have the time to do some other things as well. Especially in urban spaces. Like, I am a part of Gujarat Mahila Manch or I'm a part of some other collective, apart from also doing a full-time job. But in these rural community-based collectives, jo aapne unse seekke, unhi ke upar imply kar diya hai, is for them the only source of income, for them a full-time job, and then you impose this whole understanding of you should not be asking money from us, should be here for the sake of passion or whatever that means. And you should feel the sense of kinship with each other. And why? I am allowed to not probably feel connected to the other person. And like, if I was a part of Gujarat Mahila Manch, for example, I would never go to those people if I personally face any violence. Maybe. That can be a scene. And I would go to somebody who probably doesn't even identify as part of that collective, and I would find that person more resourceful, or even if not resourceful, just somebody I can rely on in general. This freedom somehow vanishes when we create collectives in communities, na, as feminists. So, I mean, this is also the larger debate that we keep having of NGOs and collectives, and how NGOs work in collectives, and how NGOs are like trying to call themselves collectives but functioning in structures which are not collective, and also then imposing that structure in some other collective. All of this, and I'm just feeling like, wo sab mein, when you juxtapose monetary aspirations with ideological aspirations and justify the lack of one with the other, ki you should not have monetary aspiration because you are certain ideology, I think that's where you're failing the ideology itself. Abhi recently, I think this is something that day before yesterday, I think I got really riled up with this whole COVID relief thing going on. I was just like, you have this women's collective that you're working with, and you're, now that this COVID has started spreading in villages, you have decided that we want to do something, want to work with them. So now you sent all of these people into the field and said, jao abhi gaon gaon jao aur ghar ghar jao aur do this and do that. When these things were happening in your cities, you did not step out of your room. You were capable of whatever, raising whatever kind of resources from your laptop or whatever. But here, there is a whole set of, and then what will happen? This will get reported as an accomplishment for the organization, as an accomplishment of how great we are working with the community. The actual people actually working in the community, in this kind of rights-based space, are the people from the community, who are not even paid for the kind of work that they're doing. I find it so problematic. I just feel like, how can you do that? And you are not asking them. You can't just box it into some kind of heroic thing that you're doing and just glorify that struggle. And then later take that report into international organization spaces and say that, oh, see, we did such great work during COVID. No, you did not.
It's also a reluctance for credit sharing. It's a huge problem in terms of who becomes the face of the organization, the change, the labor. It's very, very, very skewed to certain people. It is very, very, very focused on certain people. And yeah, and I think that ultimately impedes the movement. It really, really impedes the movement. Is these large NGOs with very prominent, very powerful women as their faces, that all are seen as the leaders of the feminist movement, and who are almost a black hole in themselves, and that, you know, they usurp all the power and the credit, and even if not consciously, they are seen as the face of the movement. And that becomes so problematic to diversify anything. You're already, as young women, you're already carrying massive imposter syndromes, okay? And then to have spaces where you're not validated, spaces that should be ideally validating you and giving you that support and giving you that confidence and giving you that ability to feel good about who you are and what you bring to the table. Those same spaces invalidating you, making you feel small, making you feel like questioning yourself again. There has to be accountability for the layers of reinforced imposter syndromes that these spaces have created in young women. So the whole generation.
One more thing which is important, which you guys spoke about, like the whole Gandhian concept, is sub bartan dhore, etc. But the point is ki main sirf organization mein bartan dhore. There is a woman who's fucking like washing utensils like for 5 hours before she came to work.
We had a colleague whose mother was a domestic worker, and she came to our office, and we had this Gandhian understanding of sab bartan dhoenge. But she had a very clear politics. She was like, I have grown up seeing my mother doing this. I'm not going to do this. I will not wash utensils in the office. And I was like, how can I counter that? So there was a thing to say when if I was in the office as a project coordinator and I was going and washing my own dishes, great. If I pick up rest of the dishes and start washing, I'll be immediately glorified. Oh my God, see, she's doing that. Then, but all our Sangathan women, that was their daily job. And I'm not even going into men and women here. I'm just talking about sheer privilege. There were people in the office who would drink a cup of tea and keep the cup there and nobody will question them. But there'll be huge fights happening within the Sangathan leadership ki on the same issue ki hamara culture to ye hai ki aap apna sab kuch khud se doge.
So yeah, I've had like bosses tell me that, oh, this is like, you know, you urban people, I tell you, look at my house. I said, your house was built very differently. I can't afford this even in a small setting, so please. This I think the New Yorker or Wall Street Journal had a great article for the lockdown and how everybody in the world was making sourdough bread, okay. And it had a this thing about that they was who jo baker hai na jo sourdough bana raha hai kisi bakery mein, one, he's trained, he, she, they are trained for it, but the time as well as the money involved in making that sourdough is way lesser than when a lawyer at Manhattan is doing it, because the bread loaf is very expensive then, including the time and effort. So wo capitalism to kahi se bhi negate nahi kar raha hai, because the amount of money is way more than that bakery somewhere else. So I think it's also that you know, you don't recognize these efforts. And if that person has to come to whichever city with her mother, imagine the cost of fucking coming and shifting to that city and staying then.
And she has her own ways of, like, her own culture. She eats certain kind of food that you will not get in Gujarat, you know.
Correct.
And then you want to just lift her entire life, bring it there, because you are capable of doing that. You should do that. Why can't you do that? Are you here? And
why can't you pay me more?
Yeah.
No, that. Taboo. And everybody who is like new in the organization will be constantly told ki dekho tum, you get so much more money than these other people who are already in the organization. The same example that you gave in the beginning na, matlab ki you're constantly compared to other people who are getting less money than you, not the other way around ki matlab unki salary bhi bada dete hain, inka kam nahi hai, inka sahi hai, inka badhane ki zarurat hai. Matlab you create unequal salary structures and then you weaponize them only against people to clamp down on aspiration and to get more work out on them. Oh my God. Which is why I keep saying at some point there was a huge sort of shift in salaries that they made, because they set up some salary slabs finally, which is great. Structures and salary slabs are good. They gave, and I kept telling people, don't call it an increment, call it a salary adjustment. Correction. Call it a salary correction. This is what you deserved all along, because it's in our language that we start only thinking ki wah 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 kitna de diya ab to I'm obliged. No, this is what they should have been paying all along. There should be some remuneration for all the underpaying that they did before also. Wo nahi aane wala hai, toh phir chill maro. I feel like we are all operating in these very familiar templates of how leadership should be and how leadership should look and what leadership should do. And I think all of us in our own spaces, at least the three of us here and maybe a lot of people listening, are in their own ways trying to break out of those templates, trying to create either better templates for the individual leader or for the structure in which the leader operates in at large. And I think both of those things have to keep going on. And they have to keep plugging in to what does that look like and what is it. And that as long as the self-reflexiveness doesn't go away. I think there is the potential to become more and more feminist in our practice of leadership, and to demand more and more feminist institutions and movements. And I think that is very important. And I think somehow or the other, Payana, keep ending up talking to people that have a lot of these similar experiences. And I think it goes back to what Anamika, you were saying in the beginning. It's the idea is not to trash, you know, NGOs or the development sector or feminist organizations. The idea is essentially to normalize these conversations and say these are okay questions to be asking in the spaces where we operate, because for so long we've been socialized into thinking that the development sector, you have to have this holier-than-thou approach. You have to feel like, okay, less underpaid, overworked is okay. You have to feel like certain practices being overlooked or certain identities being overlooked are okay because you're somehow plugging into a larger structure of change and that is more important than this. No, it is not more important than this. This is part of that change. We are all units of change. Yeah.
When we started the podcast and when we did this, one journey that I personally went through was that my relationship with Arundhati had started literally like this. She was the feminist boss in my life and she was the only boss in my life. And in some ways, and I don't know if I've ever said this to you, Arundhati, but this is a thought that keeps coming to me, that I have been spoiled because of her. I mean, I'm so scared. One of the reasons I'm scared to go in any other organization is that what if I have to deal with a boss who is not feminist, who's not like Arundhati, and then how will I deal with it? Because in my head, that has become a template. Other thing is, the relationship that we started off was the relationship till the end. So then when we switched into this different mode of working together, like I have been through a whole like reflective space of trying to understand that now what will this relationship look like? Like it has taken me a long time to deconstruct that in my own head and say that now she's not my manager. this relationship here, she's my partner. I would write that me and my partner, but in my head there was always a resistance because I always looked up to her. So even if whatever form of equitable relationship it was not completely equal. So at some point it'll reach there, it'll take its own time for me also to be able to completely shed it off. In all of that, today when we were having this conversation, I realized that in some ways in this podcast itself, the idea was to start in some form build some kind of collective, some kind of sense of community, without anybody being anybody's boss.
I think one thing is what Deepa said is very important. And I think I always go back to my mentor, just constantly. She's also in Bangalore, by the way. So like with people like Arundhati or my mentor, I think what is important is that they do like a benchmarking. And not in the bad way where only that is the template which should be followed. But they do a benchmarking for your expectations and somebody who's trying to come in or who's trying to be feminist or who's feminist but trying to, you know, having a better understanding of it. So they also set expectations for bosses, right? For any kind of bosses. Like even for me, my non-feminist amazing bosses also who have just been cis men, there is a benchmarking for expectations. Like I expect quality, I expect mentorship, even if I'm 31, even if I'm 45. If you are my manager, which means that there is a greater understanding of a few things, not all, but a few things. And thus, these are the expectations. These are the questions I can ask. So you also become a better professional and within feminist spaces also, but a more nuanced feminist, I think, with greater understanding. So I think these individuals then play that greater roles in our life. I work with my mentor just for, like 5-6 months, right? But she has been in my life forever. Now we discuss everything.
So this is a conversation that I think was on the tips of my Deepa and my tongues. So it's important to get it out of the system. Not just important to get it out of the system, but also I think process it in a very almost constructive way. I never thought this would be a constructive podcast.
Same. I also think this.
Anyway, so thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
No, you invited yourself and I think I love it. I wish everybody would just self-invite.
yes, definitely.
Yeah. We put out an episode every Friday. You can follow us at Fursat Feminism on Instagram. You can email us at fursatfeminism@gmail.com. We're on every podcasting platform now. The only place you can leave us a review is on iTunes. So do that. And we will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sarah.